are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, March 20th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Trump to Ohio as his trade policy threatens to slaughter the Rust Belt. Meanwhile, the Electoral College is not going away, but it is on the table. And in Florida, Andrew Gillum starts a massive voter drive while Florida Republicans try and undermine the voter enfranchising constitutional amendment passed there. Meanwhile, Trump's North Korea negotiation team is falling apart. And the White House now admits that the Republican tax cuts failed, but for the make the millionaires richer part. Europe fines Google $1.5 billion. And white-collar prosecutions hit historic lows. Good news! Means that they finally learned their lesson and they're not committing any more crimes.
We're just going to take our money and just go away.
Joe Biden ready to jump into the race as the front runner. We'll see how long that lasts. And the Trump administration repeated law breaking, stymied by their sheer incompetence and the courts, for now at least. All that and more. On today's program, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. It is Wednesday. Thank you for joining us. Going over some news stories. The 2020 race is heating up. It has some pretty big implications, not the least of which I want to start with just a piece that Matt Iglesias wrote, actually, that discusses the sort of the demobilization that seems to have taken place with the resistance, as it were. And it can be seen in the context of this emergency order to build the wall. No calls for phone calls. No protests. Nothing like what we saw with the Kavanaugh hearings. Nothing like what we saw with any number of fights leading up to the 2018 election. Now, part of this is a function of just leading up to the 2018 elections and the close proximity of elections gets people's heart rate going a little bit. And then, of course, winning in such a grand fashion in 2018, although, you know, you've won a battle, not necessarily a war, also tends to demobilize people. There's multiple theories as to what's going on. You didn't see Democrats attempt to mobilize people around H.R. 1. Maybe part of the theory is that you're not going to pass it in the Senate. But the idea of getting people, and this, you know, this will tie into Elizabeth Warren's call to get rid of the Electoral College as well. There is value in raising issues and in fighting for issues that, you know, are not going to win anytime in the near future or maybe ever. And attempting to generate grassroots action around a political reform bill. I mean, you talk about restoring the Voting Rights Act. You talk about voter registration. You talk about giving a federal holiday for federal workers on Election Day. You talk about providing some measure of uniformity to the voting process across state to state to state. You talk about adding the disclose a bill to try and get some measure of accountability when it comes to political contributions, matching funds. I think it was 6-1 matching funds for running for Congress. And then ethics reforms, stuff that you would think should be illegal already. Like, you can't sit on a committee that you have holdings in the company that is affected by that, or
but
you can't
you
use
know
insider
better things about the company.
Right.
You know better.
So-called business acumen.
It's called acumen.
But the idea, I mean, and it's, you know, at first, certainly in retrospect, I acknowledge that this was happening. Of course, there was a lot more attention paid to Ilhan Omar and within even the Democratic circles than trying to generate some type of grassroots action, even if it is to promote a bill that can never pass and won't even be brought up in the Senate. You put pressure on Mitch McConnell. Why are you not doing that? And there's a couple of different theories as to why this demobilization has taken place. One is that there's a fear amongst the leadership of the Democratic Party that this type of mobilization will lead to relentless calls for impeachment, which they fear from a political standpoint, I guess, which, again, I have there's reason to not impeach on just sort of practical grounds, but that should not in any way dampen the impetus behind it from a political standpoint. There's also the fact that it's not as clear. Once you've won the House, you don't have the same dynamic to generate people. And then all of this energy now, where you had the candidates, the would-be candidates who all knew they were running a year ago, were running on and were promoting issues and were trying to get out in front of issues. They're doing that now to a certain extent, but they're also basically trying to run for president. And so you've got, what are we at, 12 now? People fighting Trump in Washington, he says, aren't asking for grassroots help. There's a small army of Democrats roaming Iowa and the early primary states who are asking for grassroots help to fight each other. Which is true. I mean, all these dynamics are at play right now, and it is somewhat problematic. I'm not sure what the solution is, but it is an interesting phenomenon to watch and see if that changes. Now, of course, this is early in the new Congress, and we're just starting to ramp up hearings, but you've already seen the Democrats seem to sort of back off a little bit off of getting taxes, Donald Trump's taxes. Maybe they're waiting to do this next year. I don't know. Maybe they're all waiting for the Mueller report to drop. We get new notices every couple of days that it's going to drop within days, and then there's a punt. So there's this sort of like state of stasis. And, you know, we're going to be talking more, you know, at the same time, like I feel the same pull. We're going to talk about Elizabeth Warren and Beto O'Rourke today. And because that's out there, that's what people are thinking about and probably should be. So it's a bit of a dilemma. But we'll keep an eye on it and see if we see Democrats or affiliated groups, we should say, on the left, more institutional groups attempt to reinvigorate this sense of at least activism and getting people mobilized in some fashion. It's also really hard to do for 4 years straight without a break, particularly after everybody, you know, it's coming out of the last November. But there is a point where it's like, all right, we haven't won the championship, as it were. We're still in the playoffs, right?
All-star break.
Right, yeah. But the break's getting a little long.
We're still icing up.
Anecdotally speaking, that's absolutely true. I didn't even think about it until just now, but I think the last big action that the DSA did that we saw a lot of other people and groups at as well was the Kavanaugh protests. But we're still doing stuff, and everyone is, as always, welcome to join. You don't have to be a socialist to demonstrate against the Trump administration.
I mean, early on, we saw, you know, some protesting around the Green New Deal, but it wasn't necessarily a full-on mobilization. But we'll see. Folks, as you know, you spend a third of your life in sheets. And it's about time for a bedding upgrade. Brooklinen named the winner of the best online bedding category by Good Housekeeping. Brooklinen has more than 35,000 five-star reviews. Wow. That's because, I mean, I have now, I think, four sets of Brooklinen sheets. It's because by eliminating the middleman and working directly with manufacturers and customers, Brooklinen offers luxury sheets without the luxury markup. And with over 25 colors and patterns, these sheets don't just feel great, they look great, too. You've heard me... You know what I didn't realize is that Brooklinen, I mean, maybe I did, or I just sort of, I wasn't sure, but they're a Brooklyn company. They're in Brooklyn. Is that obvious? I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
They have basically two types of sheets. The more, I guess, luxurious feeling or the cool, crisp feeling.
Mm.
I go for the cool, crisp. I think that's pretty obvious. People would know that quite a bit.
Cool and crisp.
Exactly. And, you know, the thing in my experience, as someone who keeps things for a long time, and I don't want to expand on that too much, but I'm not someone like, it's rare you can ever see me wear something that you can't go back and look at a video 8 years ago and I had the same shirt. But quality sheets last for a long time, and these are quality sheets. They feel good, and they look good, and I know they're going to last me. I've had my Brooklinen sheets, at least the ones I'm thinking about specifically, the stripes, which I don't think they make anymore. The type of stripe, sort of like this, sort of like my shirt, actually. Almost identical to my shirt. I guess I don't really have a wide range of genre that I enjoy, too. But they look as good as they did when I got them over a year and a half ago, I think. My Brooklinen sheets are the best. And like I say, the most comfortable I've ever slept on. Now it's time for your upgrade. Brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer for just my listeners. Get 10% off your first order and free shipping when you use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. Brooklinen is so confident in their product that all their sheets, comforters, and towels come with a lifetime warranty. The only way to get 10% off your first order and free shipping is to use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. That's Brooklinen, Brooklinen.com, promo code MAJORITY. Brooklinen, these really are the best sheets ever. And once again, today's episode of the Majority Report is supported by Pitchfork Economics with Nick Hanauer. It's a weekly podcast that explores why everything you learned in Econ 101 was wrong and why if we don't get economics right, the pitchforks are coming. Every week on Pitchfork Economics, zillionaire investor Nick Hanauer is joined by some of the world's most original economic thinkers in a convention-busting exploration of who gets what and why in the American economy. Pitchfork Economics explains why a $15 minimum wage is actually good for business, why taxing the rich spurs economic growth, and why a thriving middle class is the primary cause of prosperity. Sarah Cory Booker explains why curbing corporate greed would actually be good for corporations and the economy. Historian Yuval Harari explains how those in power use storytelling to shrink your paycheck. And economist Stephanie Kelton scolds Democrats for worrying too much about how we're going to pay for things, not enough about what we need to do. If you want to learn how to make the economy work for all Americans and not just the wealthy few, subscribe to Pitchfork Economics at pitchforkeconomics.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Nick Hanauer, been a guest on this program, so has too Stephanie Kelton. Maybe we've had Yuval Harari. It sounds like
we've Sapiens. I don't think we ever quite got him.
I don't think we got there.
But he's an interesting guy.
All right, so let's do we have the Katie Pavlich video? Let's just put that up as a little, and then I want to go into some Beto O'Rourke stuff because there've been a couple of good pieces about Beto O'Rourke, and of course he is coming off of his big fundraising victory, but we'll talk about that in a moment. Katie Pavlich, apparently, you know, like, is she now like on Fox on a more regular basis now?
She seems like
the five regular contributor now?
She's the sixth of the five.
Now, wasn't she didn't she formally go out with that guy, Brandon Darby, who was the FBI informant in some protests and was running around, I think, Occupy as well, if I remember correctly. Now, we're getting way back here, but...
It looks like you're right, so, yeah.
There you go. I still got it, folks. Here is Katie Pavlich.
I didn't know Brooke Lennon was in Brooklyn. I'm a little tired, and then right. All of a sudden, boom. Chalk it.
So, Katie Pavlich, coming on, bringing the... the completely fact and historical free assessment, I mean, fact and historical free conclusions and what would you call this? Assertions about facts and history.
They keep blaming America for the sin of slavery, but the truth is throughout human
history. We should also say, and let's go back, she's talking about reparations. Now, it's my opinion that reparations actually should not just be for slavery, but for the continued racism practiced by the U.S. government through, just like official policy through the middle of the 20th century in terms of preventing the accumulation of wealth within the black community. But here is Katie Pavlich with her fact and historical free, historical and factual assertion.
They keep blaming America for the sin of slavery, but the truth is throughout human history, slavery has existed, and America came along as the first country to end it within 150 years. And we get no credit for that to move forward and try and make
good
on that.
Well, we did have a very bloody civil war.
Or over that
and
issue.
We also, and we also,
and the remnants are a long
of the racial history, and the remnants of the Civil War,
right.
Particularly blacks in the South,
correct.
Yes.
That was not
and
an easy
and
path.
Still,
I mean, that was bloody and violent and deadly.
And there were Native Americans here when we
that.
Showed up.
Yeah, we're yes. still, we my, my point out. Is that we were the country
true.
That decided to end it, and we're still dealing with the issue. But if you want to start a problem and to inflame racial tension even more, start blaming people
so.
Who have nothing to do with slavery for the sin of slavery. That is not fair. That's not the American way, and we shouldn't be doing it.
Okay.
You're welcome. Also, I'm sorry. Being a little bit pedantic here, but maybe usefully, there was a place called Haiti.
Well,
happened before,
or Britain,
or Britain,
or Spain,
or Spain,
or Sweden, yeah. And apparently the Netherlands, and Denmark, and France, Portugal, and we should also say that when the United States apparently, which was founded on this notion of ending slavery, right? Like we came along and decided to end it. That's one of the reasons why we were here.
We were going to be named the United States of Slavery Enders.
Exactly. And we're just like, and we'll do that. We will get to that in 100 or so years. And
working
by ending
it.
Slavery, what we mean is ending slavery by non-prison folk. Because, of course, we still allow for prison slavery. And this notion that somehow reparations are punishment for people who had nothing to do with slavery. No, what it is the fact is that we all, on some level, as a society, benefit from slavery, continuing to benefit today. Whether it's, across the income spectrum on some level, or wealth spectrum, but obviously far more so for those who have had great success, we're all continuing to benefit. All of the great exceptionalism of the United States was built on an enormous amount of free labor and all of the wealth that exists within the white society is at least in part a function of having less people to compete against who live in society. They will contribute to the building of that wealth, but they will not share in the building of that wealth. Things like redlining, things like providing secondary mortgages. These are all governmental policies. Things like not allowing them to have political power for the greater part of our history as a country. So it's not a question of punishing anybody. It is a question of trying to make up for that deficit, which of course also exists not just as a function of cash, but of just a deficit that's been created in terms of just a way of seeing the world. I mean, we spoke to, I guess we played that interview over the break, but it was Deep Roots. And I can't remember the Matthew, who one of the authors were. Blackwell. Matthew Blackwell. But the research that they have done shows that you can track to this day the racism of white people on a county by county level and track it directly to the number of slaves relative to white people who lived in a given county hundreds of years ago. And so if you can track the attitudes of white people based upon the ratio of slaves to white people in a given county hundreds of years ago, and you can see it play out, there must have been an impact that has equal resonance amongst ancestors of those slaves, of descendants of those slaves, and upon the community, broadly speaking. We can't track it in the same way because they were completely denied any type of political power for much of those years. So you can't see how it plays out in the context of society. But that's just a function of how little political power they had. So Katie Pavlich, oh, for everything she said in that segment.
She should go try a fast food sandwich.
She was talking as if nothing she was saying could be checked easily.
Like, I mean, even including by some former VJ libertarian who managed to at least retrieve the Civil War.
Yeah, exactly.
It was slightly important. I mean, we went really unfair. We talked about Sweden and Haiti and Portugal and Britain. But you could also even just go like, you know, that thing in our country that there's been a Spielberg movie about?
Right.
It's called The Civil War.
And when you contemplate how slavery was abolished basically through the 1800s, all those countries we mentioned before the United States, it wasn't even as if it was just those countries we were like, maybe we should get on board with this. It was also like, maybe we should get on board with this and it's going to cost hundreds of thousands of lives to get it through.
Well, and also if you read documents of anyone in America at the time, it's a very, like, they're very conscious of, like, Britain makes fun of us for still having slaves in, like, the 1820s and 30s. Like, this is a known thing that we were behind on this.
Well, you have your facts, Matt, and Katie Pavlich has hers. All right, so let's dig into Beto. As you know, Beto has come out of the gate with He tells reporters he had more than 128,000 unique contributions in the first 24 hours of the campaign. The average donation size was $47. I don't want to get nitpicky about this because I think it's sort of silly anyways. The fact is he raised $6 million. Those are real dollars. It's just a little weird that they're talking about unique contributions as opposed to unique contributors. That only stands out for me because I look at data when I look at the podcast. We can have, I mean, if I was to tell you how many unique listens we have, that could blow the doors off of some people. But the smart people who want to know how many people that we're actually reaching say how many unique listeners. Both numbers are pretty impressive, in my opinion. But nevertheless, unique contributions are always more. I mean, at $47, if I wanted to max out at $2,500, I could do, 1,250 contributions, right? No. Is that right? 125 contributions. Somewhere around there in math. The point is I could do more than one. But I'm not going to get too mathy about this. But the interesting thing about Beto at this point is, and, you know, we're going to have more time to see if he comes out he's obviously going to come out with a platform. He's obviously going to get, you know, to some degree more specific. He has a different problem than Kamala Harris has. Kamala Harris, her platform, to the extent that she has a record, has been in the minority in the Senate. Not the same opportunity to vote for or against things necessarily over the years, but has to a certain extent in the Senate. It has a fairly good voting record. Nothing, for what it's worth, has a fairly good voting record. Not such a great record as a prosecutor. Beto O'Rourke does not have a good voting record as a Democratic lawmaker. And in fact, he has a bad one from the perspective of a Democratic voter. I think from the perspective of a Republican voter, probably a pretty good one if you were a rational person in a Republican Party, if that would even makes any sense anymore. So he's going to be a little bit evasive. And now there are some people coming out. There was a Facebook post. And this isn't, you know, I think this is the only reason why I'm actually even reading this to some extent is that this is stuff that we were hearing during the race against Ted Cruz. Early on, when we were talking about Beto, his name would come up and we'd say, look, he's not the kind of Democrat you would want if you were running in, you know, anywhere else.
The Bronx.
Or not just the Bronx, though. I'm not sure this is the kind of Democrat you'd want if you were in Pennsylvania or in Ohio or in Michigan. Certainly not California,
Hawaii,
or Massachusetts.
New York.
I mean, I think like this is the kind of Democrat you would want if you were in Texas or North Dakota or West Virginia. It would
probably
start to
not
make
even
some sense.
West Virginia, because he doesn't have the kind of faux populism thing.
Yeah, I mean, he's probably a little bit more woke than you want to be in West Virginia.
Tell you what, Sam, I'm pretty goddamn woke.
El Paso, Texas, from a local standpoint, is pretty liberal. Right. I mean, this is not, you know, Texas is a big state. There's a big difference between the Bronx in New York and Elmira in New York. And El Paso is more like the Bronx to the rest of Texas in many respects. Here is a post, and again, I read this only because I heard this during the primaries, after the primary, in the general election against Ted Cruz, and it makes a lot of sense. She says that she's a former Beto staffer. I was reluctantly very transparent about this. I did not vote for him in the 2018 primaries for a lot of reasons. I'm about to dissect here, but at the end of the day, I stood behind him in the primary when it was him against Ted Cruz. I pretty much hate every single thing about Ted Cruz, she wrote. I worked my ass off for Beto. I worked 7 days a week, 12 plus hours a day, along with hundreds of other staff. I gave it all in the capacity I was in to see that his Senate campaign was successful. I fractured my foot, still knocked on doors for him on a scooter. I did all of this while acknowledging that he was far from the candidate I would have liked him to be. So, and she's going on because she knows she's going to get hammered on there for being less than unified, I guess. I mean, I think, look, and she goes on to say, I disagree wholeheartedly that discussion of Democratic candidates' strong points and weaknesses will hand Trump another 4 years. I wholeheartedly believe it's putting up a watered down candidate devoid of a bold platform, substance, and follow through that guarantees a Trump victory in 2020. I'm not convinced of that, but certainly I am convinced of the idea that putting up a candidate's strong points and weaknesses is not only not going to help Trump, I think it's going to hurt Trump. And then she goes into another piece that I'm going to skip for the time being because I'm not sure how much I'll come back to it. But she goes on to talk about Beto. He's not progressive, she says. He's not a member of the Progressive Caucus. That's true. Demonstrably true. He votes with the Republicans, also demonstrably true. And he praises the centrist middle as if it's some sort of virtue. He had an opportunity to back a great Democrat running against a Republican, Will Hurd. We'll get to this later. And he opted to remain silent to use the bipartisanship as a talking point to focus a lot of his campaign strategy and rhetoric on courting the white middle road voters, who are actually just Republicans that were disillusioned with Ted Cruz. He rationalizes his vote for the Blue Lives Matters bill, but voted against the Harvey bill because he said it wasn't good enough. But the Blue Lives Matter bill was good enough, she asks. He goes on to say he had an opportunity to prove he could be a bold leader by being at the forefront of the baby jail and asylum issue at the border of Texas. He went and he toured the facilities, but then he took no positions. He could have called to abolish ICE, but he belittled it as a bumper sticker slogan, as if the rest of his campaign is not merely a bumper sticker slogans. There was enormous grassroots energy around the issue at the time, and it had national spotlight by many media outlets. People would have overwhelmingly had more respect for him by taking a stand, particularly in the Valley, where his rhetoric didn't resonate at all and people didn't turn out for him. Now, with that said, maybe he's just strategizing. I can't go that far. I'm running in Texas. That's my editorial. She goes on to say he and his family are known gentrifiers in El Paso. His wife has a long history of ushering in charter schools in El Paso, working for them, serving on schoolchoice.org boards, charter schools. And she goes on to talk about charter schools. I hope no one listening to the sound of my voice who's been listening to this program for more than a couple months needs me to explain the problem with charter schools. Particularly in Texas. He campaigns as if he's pro-Medicare for all, but he's never signed on to H.R. 676. Despite being confronted by voters about it seemingly hundreds of times on the campaign trail. He comes in only second to Ted Cruz in the contributions he takes from oil and gas industry. And everybody's talking about his performance in Texas as if he didn't lose. The fact is he overperformed. You got to go. If you look at Obama to Clinton, Texas is trending. We're not there yet. And he outperformed Clinton by 3 or 4 points. But it's Ted Cruz, who even some of the Trumpistas were not motivated about. But so that's from this Facebook poster. A former staffer, take it for what it's worth. Oh, wait, I want to just read this one part that I don't necessarily agree with, and I'm a little bit nervous about it. She writes, there are hard truths that should be read and processed by quite a few people. Defaulting to charisma and cults of personality is the real losing strategy. Now, I'm not convinced of that, to be honest with you. My argument is not that Beto can't win because he has no policies. I think we can find a lot of example in American politics where charisma and cult of personality can take you a long way.
Yeah, politics are dumb as hell in this country.
Yeah, I mean, just go check out my book, Blaming the Electorate.
Thank you.
She writes, the culture of shaming people for having a genuine discussion about policy and voting history will only cause us to uplift a candidate devoid of substance to the general in 2020, of which people will not be inspired by turnout to vote for. And that'll be a rehash of 2016 with people, blaming people who didn't vote. I just don't think that actually is what happened in 2016. I don't think that Clinton lost because she was all charisma and no policy. I don't think that was the issue.
Raw charisma.
And so I'm not convinced that Beto is problematic insofar as there's a trouble with him winning the general election. There may be, but I'm just not convinced that that's the reason is because he's charismatic. I do think that having a president who does not address the material concerns of Americans and relies on his own charisma, who will not even campaign for the Democrat running in his district against another Republican, okay, could bring us a president who protects himself in office, loses hundreds, if not thousands, of Democratic seats across the country in state houses and whatnot. And I also am concerned about a politician who does not seem to have any politics, or to the extent that he does. Like, you know, we've talked on this program about there are Democrats whose policies I don't agree with, who may be opportunistic in many respects, but they do seem tethered to they seem to have parameters. You can push those people. My concern is that attempting to push Beto to a certain position is like, you know, trying to push an air hockey puck. You just don't know which direction it's going to go in. And there's no indication from his history that, I mean, it's possible he could go, who knows what direction he could go in, but there's no indication that he has a tendency to move to the left. And there's also no indication that he's like, you know, rooted.
Stop stealing my style, white boy.
No, I mean, people want to compare him to Obama, but Obama did have some kind of left liberal politics going in, which he sold out in many ways, but at least he had it starting out. If you don't have anything going in, like, what are you doing?
Also, regardless, I mean, even when Obama made quite centrist, tepid arguments, they were actual arguments. I mean, I said this before, but the striking contrast of a guy, it's like, it's almost like a Thomas Paine book filtered through a corporate management seminar. Like, there's nothing. It's just word salad. It's incredible. It's an insult to the electorate.
We'll see.
Or the an insult to some of the electorate. Exactly. That are dumb idiots that I hate.
So Helene Olin, who we've had on this program some time ago, she wrote a book about the sort of like the scams of personal wealth. Like
Susie Orman type of
people. Talkers.
Yeah, she's smart.
And she wrote a really interesting piece about Beto O'Rourke continuing to live his best Generation X life. Now, I know there are people who get upset with the crapping on Generation X that happens here. I'm obviously sympathetic to Generation X to the extent that I am a member of that generation. And we grew up in a pretty sterile situation. We had very little ability to impact the discourse both culturally, societally, politically, because of the size of the baby boomers, who are now just starting to die and to you know leave the stage. Some not so much. I'm not necessarily. There's certainly
insert
some
Joe Biden sound drop.
Well, I mean, some I like have stick around, but
sure.
And but she, you know, also I think a member of Generation X looks at this and points out a couple of particularly the. I don't know if I would call this full on misogyny, but certainly the double standard that exists with Beto and how a woman could never get away with what Beto has done so far. She quotes Rebecca Traister saying the idea that a woman could ever, even in a self-deprecating way, a self-deprecating conscious acknowledgement joke about how she's helping to raise her kids is inconceivable. And of course, this is the fact, of course. Never mind on the right. On the right, she would be burned at the stake. But even, frankly, in the center, there would be no room. And the center left, there would be no room for not like looking side-eyed at a female candidate who says, like, yeah, I'll get to the kids.
I never see my kids. It's awesome.
Unless it was
right.
Amy Klobuchar.
Said Elizabeth Warren.
Amy Klobuchar would be like, I beat my kids, and that's how I'll deal with Putin. And MSNBC would do a segment on how empowering that was.
That's possible.
Let's
that's
be
possible.
Real.
And she writes that Generation X, once so hip and so cool, grew up to be born-again traditionalists. The group, which ranges in age of just shy of 40 to those in their mid-50s, was never as liberated as advertised. From early on, many women of Generation X refused to define themselves as feminists, even as they supported feminist goals, told pollsters and demographers they would devote more time to their families than their own parents. She goes on to talk about Generation X. I'm less interested in Generation X than the dual standard that exists for Beto. And I'm quite convinced part of that was, you know, the Alex P. Keaton syndrome where you're rebelling against your parents who are to the left of you. Not all of us did that, but many did in that era.
God, there are so many options to rebel against your baby boomer parents. Just be a communist. What's wrong with you?
You could do that. And so she goes on to write, you can compare O'Rourke, and this is a pretty apt comparison, with his fellow female Generation X contender, Kristen Gillibrand, who also formalized her presidential run this weekend, to see how this plays out in our lives, in our civic life. Gillibrand, who moved from conservative positions to more liberal ones over the years, and she's done this over an extended period of time. I mean, she's now been a senator for, I think, close to a decade, if I'm not mistaken. And prior to that, she was a member of the House up in what was then the 20th District of New York. I'm quite familiar with that district. In fact, I voted for her at the time. She was not good on immigration. She was not good on guns. Can't remember all of her positions, but those are the two that stuck out for me. And then she's appointed senator when Hillary Clinton is appointed Secretary of State. She runs again. She has moved significantly to the left. Now, mind you, her House district, considerably more conservative than Beto O'Rourke's. Considerably more. Like 20% more. At least. So, Olin writes, she moved from a conservative position to more liberal ones over the years, branded as an opportunist Tracy Flick. She's openly and repeatedly discussed how she adjusts her schedule so she can spend more time with her children, with little and no credit, despite the fact that she's been outspoken for the better part of a decade of what could come to be called the Me Too issues. When she demanded that Al Franken resign in the wake of allegations, he groped a number of women. Many portrayed it as an operator looking to ace out a possible 2020 rival. Meantime, O'Rourke, who spoke out against the Affordable Care Act before he voted to defend it and enjoyed significant financial support from Republicans when he ran for Congress in 2012, is allowed to present himself as a progressive champion. Few seem to recall that O'Rourke declined to endorse Democrat Gina Ortiz Jones when she ran for election this year against one of his friends, Representative Will Hurd, Republican Texas. His action quite possibly cost Jones the election. She lost by fewer than 1,000 votes.
You got to be loyal to your friends, though.
Yeah, it's a little bit concerning when those friends may not be politically aligned with you.
Yeah, what do the Bernie's not a Democrat folks think about that?
So instead of getting branded as a disloyal political shapeshifter, as some will call Gillibrand, O'Rourke is touted by many as a charming unifier. Now, the issue isn't whether Gillibrand should be called a political shapeshifter. The issue to me is, why isn't Beto O'Rourke being called a political shapeshifter? I get it. He ran in, again, a much more liberal district than Kristen Gillibrand, but was running statewide. But it's not like his voting patterns were formulated in his Senate run.
Can we style guide both of them are?
Exactly.
Well, she shapeshifts based on what the voters want, and while he shapeshifts based on, you know, whose dad he's who he's married to and who his friends are. So, you know, totally different.
I mean, you could argue that he was trying to appeal to the state of Texas, right? Not so much in his House district, and that's where you see the divergence, like you're saying. Like, she had at the time, I think it was a 2-to-1 Republican to Democrat, probably on registration, maybe a little bit less. But certainly Republicans had the advantage in that district. I think it's changed. I think it's closer to 50-50 now. But so her votes may have reflected that district, whereas his votes didn't necessarily reflect that district. But it is interesting the way that the two are juxtaposed. Now, granted, he is charismatic, although I have to say that it's weird how much he has to move his arms to speak. I mean, honestly, I gesticulate, I stutter, apparently I was dubbed on the 1,000th episode of WTF as like the king of all ummers.
I think it was episode 600 or something like
it
that.
It was 1,000.
Oh,
it was
really?
The recent one, yes. Oh. No, they were going
there's
back.
An even more recent one?
Oh, yeah, 1,000.
Oh, wow.
But I don't know. It is weird to contemplate. Like what it's going to take. I mean, you know, the disadvantage a woman has with the exact same profile, but I mean, it is a pretty close approximation. I mean, if you want to make an analogy between these two, it's pretty accurate, seems to me.
Well, it's like someone said on Twitter, why would he stand for something when he could stand on something?
Can I make the side point outside of this essential point that you've broken down? And maybe it's actually not even a side point, it's a point in and of itself. And thanks for IMing it, Brendan, and I was going to mention this, that there's also the like dimension that Hurd has come out publicly and been like, I'm supporting the Republican nominee, period. I don't care if my buddy's running.
Right.
So there's also, it's like, that perfect fusion that is represented in all too many Democrats of, well, total personal and selfish, you know, I will do literally anything for myself. That's Beto completely. And also I'll be sort of weak in a way because I will bend over backwards for people who actually do, operate on pretty like, intense, aggressive political principles, as they should. And that also is another interesting, like, look, I will plug Bernie for a second, but I'm sure that this goes for all the rest of them. I mean, but Bernie's the one saying every speech, I will support the Democrat. I will support the Democrat. He's also spending more time talking about Trump than anybody else. And I just think it's such a perfect underline, though, that it's like Beto will screw over people who will vote for him and his own party happily. But then he will kowtow to a guy that he thinks is his buddy. And that guy's like, sure, but I'm voting for Trump.
And this is a good time to just pivot for a moment to Elizabeth Warren. Then we'll go to the fun half. We'll talk more about her and we'll play that Beto clip. But let's talk about Elizabeth Warren talking about the Electoral College. Because that tendency of Democrats that Beto had in endorsing the Republican candidate overheard over the Democrat who ends up going and losing, losing by 1,000 votes. And then having that same Republican say, yeah, no, it's not reciprocal.
He was buddies with him, right?
Well, apparently.
They are buddies.
Apparently it's
the guy didn't say their buddyship was canceled. He just said he's not voting for
my
his
love
buddy.
For him is unconditional.
Right, but Beto could have had the same, like, he's a great guy. He's one of my favorite members of Congress. Gina Ortiz, I look forward to working with her, and I endorse her because we're both Democrats.
Exactly.
But this, we'll have a beer, win or lose.
I'll invite my buddy up to the D.C., and he can check out my office now that he's gone once Gina Ortiz is in.
Take him out for a beer
but
after he
this,
loses.
This dynamic of the Democrats pushing some type of, like, I'm looking for the good Republicans. That I'm going to meet the Republicans halfway. This strategy has been a unequivocal failure over the past couple of decades. This idea that Democrats are going to show up at the knife fight with, like, you know, a spoon. And, you know, what I'm going to try and do first, I'm going to feed them some soup during this knife fight. No, it doesn't work. And this is what I like about Elizabeth Warren talking about the Electoral College. Let's play this clip.
The next question comes from Rukia Lumumba. She's a legal advocate and community organizer here in Jackson. She also happens to be the sister and former campaign manager of Jackson's current mayor, Shokwe Antar Lumumba. Her late father, Shokwe Lumumba, was also once the mayor of this city as well.
Pause for 1 second. Side note. We interviewed Shokwe Lumumba at Netroots Nation. He is considered self-proclaimed desire to be the most radical mayor in the country. Really interesting guy. Go back and look for that. I think that was in August, or the first week of August of 2018. But go ahead.
Once the mayor of this city as well. Okay. Rukia.
All right.
Good to
Thank
see you.
You. Thank you. Thank you for being here. Welcome to Jackson, Mississippi. Yeah. So voter disenfranchisement is real. Mm-hmm. In Mississippi, there are 23 felonies that once convicted ban a person from voting for the rest of their lives, literally limiting their citizenship and right to democracy. Mm-hmm. Moreover, residents' access to voting is limited by archaic voter registration processes and limited voting formats. How will you expand voting rights to the formerly incarcerated, ensure online voter registration, and non-excuse early voting?
All right. Great question. But can I go you one bigger?
Yeah.
And that is, I believe we need a constitutional amendment that protects the right to vote for every American citizen and to make sure that vote gets counted. We need to put some federal muscle behind that. And we need to repeal every one of the voter suppression laws that is out there right now. And I'll tell you one more. We need to make sure that every vote counts. And I want to push that right here in Mississippi, because I think this is an important point. You know, come a general election, presidential candidates don't come to places like Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They also don't come to places like California and Massachusetts. right? Because we're not the battleground states. Well, my view is that every vote matters. And the way we can make that happen... is that we can have national voting, and that means get rid of the Electoral College and every vote counts.
Okay, so the means in which to get rid of the Electoral College either be a constitutional amendment. There is also what is known, and we've talked about on this program, the National Popular Vote Compact, which is essentially an agreement among states that they will alter their constitutions in such a way that they will agree to award their electors to the winner of the popular vote. And you need, obviously, enough states that equal 270 electors. Right now, Colorado was the most recent to vote this in and sign it into law at the very least. I don't know if they amended their constitution or not, but that brings the total to somewhere, I think, around 200. There's a couple of states that are looking to do this before the 2020 election, but we're not going to get to 270 anytime soon. I don't know that we'll ever get to 270 because I don't know that a Republican-dominated state is going to sign on to this for obvious reasons. So we're not going to get a constitutional amendment. We're not going to get this national popular vote compact. It's not going to go through anytime soon. What is the value of Elizabeth Warren in the context of a presidential election in 2020? Really, a Democratic primary, but a presidential election in 2020. What is the value of her saying this? In addition to the fact that obviously these type of reforms take years, and these are long-term movements, the value of it is also signifying to both the Republican and the Democratic Party, to the American public, that there is something amiss here. That we're no longer going to just worship at the altar of norms that are problematic. The Electoral College, highly undemocratic, right? It's not one person, one vote. It just doesn't work out that way. If it was, we would have President Clinton right now. If it was, we would have President Gore. There may have been no Iraq War. Who knows what the trajectory of history? There may have not been a 9/11. Who knows what the trajectory of the United States would have been if we had actually followed the will of the people as expressed by the votes? Now, that's not to say that it's rigged or that it was a technical victory, although I think in the case of at least George Bush, I could tell you it was... it was vote theft, and that was a function of the Supreme Court, as far as I'm concerned. But this is a problem. It's anti-democratic. And every person in the country, whether it is the law of the land or not, should be aware that it's anti-democratic. We should be aware that the Senate is fundamentally anti-democratic. That the number of people who control the policies of our government, of the lawmaking of our government, is less than the people who are at the whim of those people. In other words, there are millions of people more who voted for Democratic senators than there are who voted for Republican senators. Yet Republicans have control of the Senate because of the way that senators are voted. Each state gets two, regardless of population. That's the way it's been set up. Whether we like it or not, that is the Constitution. We could change it, but we're not going to get to the point where we can change it. But we should know that it's fundamentally anti-democratic because that's going to implicate other politics. And Democratic politicians are no longer afraid of raising these issues And it is because they have, rightly so, sort of, you know, are able to begin to see the reality of the situation, which is many of these anti-democratic features are not just a function of of legacies, but are also enhanced and abused by the Republican Party. Right? I mean, you still have Democrats talking about reinstituting the filibuster. In other words, we will get back into power if we take over the Senate. And because we know the Senate is an anti-democratic institution, at least in the context of the Republicans, when the Republicans control it, just structurally, it's almost impossible for it to be anti-democratic when Democrats control it, because they will get more votes. We will never have, at least in our lifetimes, an era where Democrats will control the Senate, where the majority of Americans have not voted for Democrats to be the senator, to control the Senate. And despite that, Democrats, you still have Democrats. Democratic senators are saying, we're going to give them, even though that's the most Democratic outcome the Senate can exist, we're going to give the minority the ability to filibuster, to stop us. Whereas Republicans, who sit in control of the Senate with far less people voting for them, they strip the filibuster.
In the naive and absolutely horrifying words of Richard Blumenthal, and this was about a year and a half ago, so maybe he's wizened up, two wrongs don't make a right.
Right. And Beto O'Rourke, on one hand, when he endorses the Republican, or he refuses to endorse the Democrat running against his Republican buddy because he wants to maintain some sense of collegiality, when he gets up there and he says, you know, I want to bring people together, which incidentally is what Glenn Beck says. It's what Glenn Beck says when he was apologizing for supporting Trump, and it's what Glenn Beck said the other night on Hannity when he said, I'm supporting Trump now. I'm against Trump. We need to bring people together. I'm for Trump. We need to bring people together.
Just different groups of people bringing
in
together.
In other
here.
Words, credulous bringing liberals people or a white nationalist. Together in the context of politics is meaningless claptrap. When Elizabeth Warren comes out and calls for the abolition of the Electoral College, at the very least, even though we're not going to see that policy change for a long time, if ever, she's putting down a marker and saying, I know, and you should know, there's a fundamentally undemocratic dynamic that is at work here. And it is highly problematic to providing people with the material benefits that they want out of their government. And when that is stymied, when the government is not working, despite the fact that the people have expressed their will as to how they want it to work, and particularly when you do not have the arc of justice in your favor, you start to get stuff like Donald Trump. And so that's why I love the fact that Elizabeth Warren is making a campaign issue of something that will never happen with her as president.
But then her friends across the aisle might not want to have a beer with her later, and that might make her sad.
It may make her sad. I don't think so. I don't think she cares that much about the beer.
It's not just about the beer. It's also about friendship. And friendship is great. And democracy is great. And I just believe if we can have friendship plus democracy equals MC square. And lots of moving around.
Everything he says with a note.
And then
I am strumming a guitar.
Matt, if we could bed a West Wing a soundtrack under this, that would really be great.
All right, we got to take a break. I wanted to get to more clips of Elizabeth Warren.
Iraq. Can we just mention, we missed, this is the 16-year anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. Everybody missed it in prep, but that's all around. So we should just know that we killed hundreds of thousands of people. We lied about it.
Ari Fleischer's still lying about it.
Ari Fleischer's still lying about it. And the country, though, was brought together, actually, in a way through total lies, propaganda, and Islamophobia.
Not totally together, I can tell you that.
70%,
right now.
I believe, on the eve of the invasion. With the
done
honorable exceptions of Noam Chomsky, Janine Garofalo, and Sam Cedar.
There was others. but you couldn't hear about them that much, actually. All right, we're going to take a break. I just realized, too, that would mean 11 days from the 15-year anniversary of me doing radio.
Just realized. Far out.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Just a reminder, folks, it is your support that makes this show possible. By becoming a member, you support The Daily Show. We bring you long-form interviews. We bring you some deep dives into the news. And then, as a way of saying thank you, we give you the fun half, wherein we make fun of different people. And today, I know we're going to blow the lid off this whole David Pakman thing, which is blowing up on the internet. And Mike Cernovich apparently loses another one. This guy's completely retreating into a sort of a, like, I think he's going to be a yoga guy soon, would be my guess.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No, nothing wrong
with
it.
That would be great.
But no, that's what I'm saying.
To, yoga
get him out of, that's what I'm saying. Get him out of politics.
Fair enough. That's right.
Like
namaste, bro.
In the fun half.
Namaste.
We're going to talk a little bit more about. We're going to talk about the Donald Trump's love affair with a his mentor, maybe a model, Bolsonaro. Definitely handing it to those SJWs with Donald Trump. We will talk all about that in the fun half.
His sons are so fit. And they're connected to gangs that kill people. It's so unfair. My sons are so stupid.
So
hashtag me too.
Boys, you can become a member of the Majority Report by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Michael, last night was Tuesday.
Last night was an incredible historical deep dive with Harvey Kay and Daniel Bessner. You're going to have to watch it to find out. There's too much to even tease. I will say I was actually pretty proud of myself with our opening commentary connecting the history of imperialism and Gramscian's hegemony ideas with the terrorism in Christchurch. This Sunday, Illicit History of Joe Biden with Zach Carter. We're releasing an Illicit History for Everybody with Nelson Deniz on Puerto Rico and colonialism. Patreon.com/TMBS. Get the whole thing and become also you can watch us on our YouTube channel where things are now very regularly clipped up, and you'll get a real sense of the show that way. At Michael Brooks Show on YouTube, patreon.com/TMBS.
Jamie.
So out today on the Antifada, we talk with cartoonist, writer, and all-around provocateur Ellie Valley. He's fresh off some altercations with Jewish activists like Ben Shapiro and Meghan McCain and Chelsea Clinton. We had a good conversation about his little, the conflicts he's having with the Zionist establishment, the idea of Jewish identity, the Zionist idea versus the diaspora idea. We talk about his book, Diaspora Boy, and also what the Zionist establishment might make of a certain presidential candidate from Vermont. So check it out.
And Matt.
King Philip's War and the Mary Rowlandson captivity narrative. We talk about sort of the moment when the Indians that are Native Americans that live in the Massachusetts, New England area realized that they were going to need to fight to keep their land. And check it out.
All right. See you. See you in a moment. Oh, just a reminder. Today's episode of the Majority Report, supported by Pitchfork Economics with Nick Hanauer, a weekly podcast that explores why rising income inequality will lead to pitchforks and what we can do about it. Every week, Hanauer is joined by some of the world's most original economic thinkers in a convention-busting exploration of who gets what and why in the American economy. If you want to learn how to make the economy work for all Americans, subscribe to Pitchfork Economics at pitchforkeconomics.com. Or wherever you get your podcasts. See you in the fun half.